Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening and welcome to Peach State Pandemonium for Thursday, June 26th, 2014. This is Michael Norris. I'm joined by one of my partners. Jerry Oates is with us, still waiting on Jay and Bobby. Jay had a meeting this afternoon. He was hoping to get here and get on the line with us by 8 o'clock, but I'm sure he'll be calling in here shortly. Bobby is on his way home from church. I just talked to him. He'll call in here in a few minutes. To give us a road report. But anyway, how are you doing this evening, Jerry?
Mike, I'm doing great. How are you, sir?
I'm hanging in, getting a little better each day in minuscule steps, but it's still moving forward. So I've gotten rid of my shingles, so that's a positive thing.
I heard that is just something horrible to battle.
I was lucky, I guess. Mine wasn't too bad. I've heard horror stories. It hurt for a day or two, but, I mean, it was nothing, you know, absolutely, you know, deathly bad. The worst part was that my eye was swollen shut. My left eye was swollen shut for a day or two, but I was lucky that it did not get in my eyes. What my doctor told me that really causes problems if it does get into your eyes, so I was lucky that that didn't happen. So, I've been pretty lucky all the way around, I guess. The things that would have put most people away, I've managed to deal with. I've had my moments, but for the most part, I've dealt with them pretty well.
You know, so, taking care of yourself.
I'm trying to. Once I get where I can be much more active than I am, I intend to do a whole lot more as far as walking and trying to, you know, maybe get back in the gym at some point, because I know one thing, I'm not putting that weight back on. I don't care what
Please
happens,
don't.
I'm not going to do that.
That is just so bad for you for so many reasons, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, it had a lot to do with what eventually happened to me, so, but I'm lucky it didn't happen anytime sooner, and I'm lucky I was here instead of on the road when it did happen, so, I'm going to make sure that risk is not in my life anymore. So, but before we get started, since Jay's not here to do our commercial for it, I'm going to do it. And just let everybody know that's listening to us that today's sponsor is Audible.com, who is a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. You listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you can with them. And I know several people do listen to audiobooks on Kindles and Nooks and things like that. But if you want to give them a 30-day free trial, you'll get a free book when you sign up for it at audibletrial.com/GWH Radio. So you guys that are interested in audiobooks and stuff like that, go give them a listen. And hopefully Jay will be here to read the next commercial, because he does a much better job than this. He does this for a living, so he's much better at it than I am. But also want to wish a happy birthday to three people. Jim Dillon, for one. I can't bring myself to call him JJ. I'm sorry. He's Jim Dillon to me. Today is his birthday, as is our friend Al Friend, who did the show with us a couple years ago. Best known in the wrestling business as Percival A. Friend, who was a manager in Kansas City in Central States for many, many years. I know Jerry was around him when he and Ted were up there. And also a new generation of the wrestling business, even though he's not new to the business. He's been around a while now. Our friend Kyle Matthews, today is his birthday as well. And so I want to wish a happy birthday to the three of those gentlemen from Peach State Pandemonium. And also give an update on Bob Kelly. Bob Kelly went back into the hospital yesterday to have some more fluid removed from around his lungs, and they took another liter of fluid out yesterday. They were hoping for him to be released today, but as of this afternoon, he was still in the hospital. They wanted to run some more tests. But I haven't talked to him, but Bill Sawyer talked to him, and he said he sounds much better. So he's not feeling as bad as he was with all that fluid around him. But hopefully Bob will get out tomorrow, because Saturday is his birthday, and we don't want him in the hospital on his birthday. I went through that. It's not fun. I spent Christmas, New Year's, my birthday, and Easter in the hospital, and none of it was fun. So.
No, I'm
hopefully,
sure.
Bob will be home on his birthday by Saturday, and he can spend it with his family and everything. So we're wishing him best of luck and an early happy birthday as well. So anyway, we'll kind of wing it here till our co-host get here with us. But what's happening down in Savannah? Anything new and exciting happening?
It's hot weather.
I don't
hot.
Get to go out much, so I don't know how hot it is here. I know it's been in the upper 80s.
You're in for a treat.
Well, actually, I am going out tomorrow. My daughter's going to take me. I've got another doctor's appointment tomorrow, so she's taking me. And it's in noon, so it'll be in the heat of the day. So.
Oh, sure. Well, you'll see what we're talking about. But it's the time of the year, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Could be worse. I could be on Long Island, New York.
Exactly. It's been hot, with afternoon thunderstorms and that type of situation, but that's just part of the course this time of year.
That's true. Same here. It's been had a shower here and there, mainly in the afternoons, but I'm sure a lot of that's because of the heat as well, so.
Yeah, we just had one just pass through here about 45 minutes ago, and it's gone. So, at least it waters the plants.
So, anything interesting happening on the beach for you?
No, it's just packed. It's been packed. It really has.
I keep forgetting. We're already in June, so yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, it's slam packed. A lot of people come down that island, I'm telling you. It's just one way on and one way off, though. So, if they have a fender bender, it turns into a...
Oh, I can imagine
lot.
So. Yeah, I can imagine. Is it mainly, do they have, like, resorts and stuff like that on Tybee Island? I've never been to Tybee. I've been to Hilton Head. I'm assuming it's similar.
Hotels, a lot of motels, and they've got a big hotel down there. They have a lot of... rentals, houses for,
right.
3 day or a week at a time or a month at a time. They have a lot of those. I mean, just tons of them. So, but some, this time of year, if you hadn't booked something in advance, if you're trying to come there on the weekend, you're just about out of luck.
I can imagine so. I guess, like I said, I've never been to Tybee. Do they have like tourist-type stuff like the Redneck Riviera down in Panama City?
Panama City. They don't have like, years ago they had rides and stuff like that, water slides and all that. They don't have anything like that. It's so limited in the size of it, anything that can be turned commercial is commercial, but they have the biggest attraction down there is the lighthouse. I don't know how many people go to the lighthouse. Everybody comes out, where's the lighthouse? Well, it's sticking up in the air, you can see it, but trying to get to it, I guess, you don't know the way. And, they have Fort Pulaski right before you get on Tybee. That's a big fort. And then they have Fort Scriven there on Tybee. But as far as there's not a lot of, you know, attractions there, so to speak, except for the beach. And that's what they come
for.
That's
enough.
That's enough.
Plus, it's not that far to Savannah. I mean, people can go into Savannah and, I guess, over to Hilton Head if they have to. You know, if they're interested in it. Hilton Head, I went there a couple of different times, and they had a lot of antique shops and stuff like that that was real neat if you're into stuff like that, which I happen to be. And there was one down there, and I don't know, I can't remember if she was a big customer there or if she owned part of it, and you may know. I think this was back in the 80s. You've heard of Kirstie Alley. There was a store down there that did a lot of not only antiques but vintage clothing and stuff like that. And she seemed like the lady when my then wife and I went in there. The lady said that she was either a part owner or was a big customer that came there quite a bit.
And, I thought she might have a buffet there or something.
That's mean, Jerry.
Well, the truth hurts sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, but as large as she is, if she gave me a call tomorrow and said, I'm passing through town, I'd go.
Yeah, I'm sure she's got
woman.
The correct change.
Oh, man. Something about her eyes. She's a beautiful woman, I tell you.
Yes, a beautiful face. She really does. It's a shame that she blew herself up like that, but
yeah, that's true.
That's
but,
her,
same.
Her
same could be said for me at one time. So,
well, at least you got a hold on it now. So,
yes, sir. It's taken me quite a bit to get a hold on it, but I'm going to stay on it because I'm not going through this again. Trust me. If I ever get over this, I will never go through this again. But, anyway, we'll go ahead and get into our subject for tonight. I want to take a look at heel turns and babyface turns. And I know, you know, that's one of the things that the product today seems to get criticized about it, is that they seem to hotshot that angle and do it way too often. But to be honest with you, I don't know how they tell the difference in a heel and a babyface nowadays because they wrestle the same way.
Yeah,
so,
I don't see the difference either. You know, if it's done right, it really means something. But just to do it, it means nothing.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly. What I would have to say, and of course you've seen a lot more than I have because you were a fan a lot younger than I was, and you know, of course, you being in the business works in many different territories, but if I had to name the most successful babyface turn, and especially of the 70s, but possibly of all time, that'd have to be Dusty Rhodes to me. I mean, because
I would,
you know,
I would say that. I really would. I mean, I think it means more when a heel turns in a baby face.
Yeah, I agree with you. I've always heard the saying, and I can't remember who to attribute it to, but I've always heard the saying that as hated, the more a heel is hated and the more heat he has with an audience, the more over he's going to be when he does turn.
And, you know, the correct way to do it, I mean, I'm talking about in territory days. Let's just say he was the top heel here, and you've been here 3 years. That's a pretty good run here in Georgia. Three, four years. You know, you could get by with 4 years. And then you did it. And then, you could have another 2 years here.
Yeah, that's true.
It would mean so much more. Because, first of all, they know you're a little damn son of a gun anyhow. But they could get behind you and believe in you, you know. To me, it just means more that way.
Exactly. I mean, because you, and again, going back to Dusty, you take, you know, Dusty had been around. He turned in 1974. He'd been around the business probably 6-7 years by that time. But he never really, I mean, he was a heel and he worked all kind of places, but he never made a real big splash, even in Florida up until that point, until he made that turn. And then that made him an attraction all over the country, Japan, everywhere else.
I know when I was in Florida in 70, that's when I first met him and Dickie Murdoch.
Yeah.
And they came in there as the Texas Outlaws. That was 1970. And I don't know if they had just, they had come in from Detroit, or where they had been, but I don't know how long they stayed, and I don't know where they went after that. But when he come, you know, when he made his return, I'm sure he's still a heel, and like you said, the rest is history. And he never switched back. It's the beauty part.
Right. That's the, and that to me is what kills it. You know, when
that
somebody switches. That exactly.
That. You know, he's going to do it and go all the way with it till it's, I'm talking territories now, until it's time for you to leave, then, you know, that's where it had the most clout to me.
Right. And he was one of the few that didn't go back. Once he turned,
right.
he never went back.
No.
Now, as far as the most successful, and I'm sure that, again, there were more that I have not seen, but from what I've personally seen, the best heel turn to me was Ole in 1980. Hold on a minute, let me get Bobby on the line with us. Bobby, you there with us?
Who, me?
Yeah. You're the only Bobby I know on the show.
I was trying to be the 100th caller. Oh.
Well, you are. You win a free date with Charlie Smith.
Thank you.
All expenses paid. All expenses paid by you.
I've seen y'all talking about Dusty. Yeah. Been down that road. I've seen y'all talking about Dusty there, the Florida thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
I was just enjoying listening. But, yeah, that's yeah, the only thing was that was some pretty serious heat that night.
And the beauty thing about that was it wasn't a sudden turn. I mean, when he turned, he stayed babyface for over a year. You know, so it wasn't like he was a babyface for a month or two and then all of a sudden turned again. And the way they did this, and I'm going to compare it to the second best one that I've ever seen. In fact, I wouldn't even call it second best. I'd call Ole's 1A and this other one 1B because they were done so similar. And it may be that Ron Fuller got the idea from Ole's turn because Ole's turn was in 80, and the other one I'm going to mention happened in either late 80 or early 81. I can't remember. And that was Jimmy Golden turning on Ron Fuller. Now, again, the Fuller-Golden, you know, thing started back in Knoxville in 78 or so. They brought it to the Mobile territory, and it carried on, where Jimmy was a heel. Well, he left and was gone for, you know, 6-8 months, and then when he came back to the Southeastern territory, you know, he had nothing to do with the Fullers. You know, he wasn't there to challenge them or nothing else like that. He started working against other heels, and his popularity just slowly grew. And again, you know, he did this and carried this on for, you know, 6-8 months. And Fuller was having problems with, I think it was Ron Bass and somebody, but I don't remember who it was. But they actually had the fans going to him, you know, to Fuller saying, look, Jimmy's changed, you know, and again, that sounds funny to people who are fans of today's product, but a lot of people actually believed, and a lot of people would go to Ron, you know, Jimmy's changed and all this, and take him as your partner, and finally, you know, they drug that out for another month, until finally Golden came in and helped Fuller a couple of times, and then so they decided to team up, and it was in a double bull rope match, and Jimmy turned on him. And that was similar to Ole. I mean, from what I understand, and Bobby, you were here at the time, fans were approaching Ole saying, you know, and approaching Dusty saying, you know, get Ole to team with you. He's different now and all this stuff. And the fans really, you know, they played that into the angle. And, of course, you know, Ole let him, you know. Go ahead,
Bobby. The night he did the turn, it was in a cage here in Atlanta. And
right.
This thing, as you said, this thing had gone on for an hour, for a year. And people, honestly, you know, only one of them people over. I mean, only the people who worked with him every day knew he was still a heel. He had thoroughly convinced everybody. They bought into it hook, line, and sinker. And the night he turned on him, it's a good thing it was in a cage. Because it could have been nasty, because it was tough getting him out of the ring that night. They left Dusty just laying there a bloody mess.
But again, that was the best in my opinion. And again, because they took their time with it, and that's what seems to be the lost art part of it today. I mean, everybody knows somebody that somebody's working. They're going to be both a babyface and a heel at some point. So if you go on all the internet message boards and stuff like that, they say, you know, John Cena's been a babyface too long. He needs to turn heel. You know, he's boring the way he is now. He needs to turn heel. You know, what do you do with this guy? He's played out. They need to turn him heel. They need to turn him babyface. And, you know, you just, number one, you don't let the audience dictate what the way your promotion is going to go anyway.
That's the fans running the business, you know. I mean,
exactly.
You can't ever get to that stage. But, I mean, it's, if you hotshot it means absolutely nothing. You know,
you're going to kill your town if you do it. And you might get away with it once, but you can't do it continuously. And the problem you've got today, just from what I see, last weekend, me and Mr. Smith spent the weekend in Kingsport, Tennessee at Bo James TV taping and at the revival of the Southeastern promotion in Knoxville. And I really don't have an opinion on the Southeastern because I don't know what they're going to do with it. That's strictly a TV product. They're not trying to run downs off of that. They're just trying to get a TV product where they can syndicate it. But I watched Bo do five. He taped enough matches to do five shows. He does a 30-minute show every week. And he is trying his best to do it old school, and he's planning ahead. He builds. He's got a thing coming up July 12th, and I watched him as he was doing his interviews and he was doing his TV. You can see he's going from week to week building toward the blow-off on the 12th and his matches at the fairgrounds there in Kingsport. The thing I find with most of these independent promotions, when I go with Charlie when he's selling his gimmicks and I'll go and just watch, none of them even know if they're going to run again. So they have no idea when they'll be back or if they'll be back. And the second thing is, everybody thinks they're a booker, but none of them are smart enough to know that if they're coming back, they got to have something that the people are willing to pay to see. So there's nothing done to entice them to come back. You're talking about building it over time, and Jerry's talking about you can't hotshot it. Nobody knows how to do it anymore. It's amazing to me. I get so frustrated. You know, you just some simple little thing, and you, at least you could stir some interest in maybe you sell extra 10 tickets next time. But I don't know. They just everybody. And you talk about the fans running the business. I had one promoter come to me one time, and he said, "What do you think about my matches?" And I said, "Well, I said they're not making. There's no continuity to them." I said, "Well, what are you trying to do?" He said, "Well, I don't know." He said, "But the people are happy." And I said, "Are you letting the people dictate what you do?" And he goes, "Well, yeah, I guess." So there you have it. They just, I don't know. Very frustrating.
Well, it's like.
It is.
It's like I heard Tom say one night, I mean, I forgot where we were. I mean, it was jam-packed. We was talking about it. He said, yeah, that's great. He says, now how, what do we do to get them to come back again?
Next week. There you go.
That's the see, that's the know-how, the know-to. And a lot of guys think they know. But see, if you don't, of course, we're talking about what we did, our time, our era. We've talked about you running the same town every week. If you just do this haphazardly, you don't have a clue. You think you do. But if you're not out there every night in different towns and seeing what works, what doesn't work, will this work, will that work, or should we go in this direction or that direction, what you're doing, it's like trying to nail smoke to a wall, which is impossible. You can't, and every town's different. Every
yep.
town is different.
And you know, Jerry, something else too here. We talk about this. For all the good runs we had, we would go through those lulls where you could have blew the ring up with a stick of dynamite and wouldn't draw anybody. I mean, you just hit a spot where, you know, Tom did it, any great booker did it, they would try something and it just wouldn't work.
You couldn't make it work.
You couldn't make it work. And the way the business works, they knew, I mean, you could have probably done something real stupid or done something real fantastic and drew a crowd the next week, but that wasn't what they were after. They were after the longevity of bringing them back week after week after week. How many programs did we watch as kids, and even after we got in the business, it ran 12, 15 weeks before they blew it off?
That is what we talk about is the lost art.
Yeah.
How do you do that? How do you do that? It just keeps building. And there comes a point you do have to blow it off. I mean, you have to.
Yeah, I mean, because it only makes sense to.
You know. But you want to get every dime out of that you can.
And if you blow it off right, a year later you can bring it right back. We talked last week about feuds and stuff like that. You know, how many years, you know, did Bob Kelly and Don Fargo beat on each other? You know, they'd take a couple years off, and when you brought it back, it was just as hot. Same thing with Ricky Gibson and Billy Spears. I mean, you know, they were just as hot in 1977 as they were in 1973 or 1972 when they first started up. You know, and if you
they
do it right, and people, especially because, and I think you guys will agree with me, the fans back in those days paid a whole lot more attention, and they knew the history behind Two Guys, you know, because you had repeat fans over and over again, and Jay just joined us. Welcome to the show, Jay.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I've just been on the expressway for the last hour and a half, which should have taken me 45 minutes, but I was very fortunate as compared to some folks that were broken down or didn't see anybody that was in life-type jeopardy, but 75 and 285 both this afternoon and evening, very, very ridiculous, but I'm finally here.
Well, good. I'm glad you're here.
Well, thank you.
Because I don't have to read that second ad. But I mean, do you guys agree with what I'm saying? You had fans that had the same seats for years, and they remembered back two or three years ago when you know Dick Steinborn and the Assassin had their feud going, and oh boy, you know they're hooking up tonight. I remember how good those matches were, you know, three or four years ago. This is going to be a barn burner.
Yeah. And them same people are the ones that would go, yeah, I know it's all fixed, but boy, I was out the night Dickie really got mad at that assassin and broke
exactly.
out in a fist fight. You know, that's
exactly.
the truth.
Exactly.
And I don't imagine Dick or Jody ever had a hard word between them in however many years.
Well, it's hard to, you know, I would think that it would be difficult to really have those kind of hard words and be able to work with somebody on a regular basis. I mean, honestly, it would be very, you know, I've worked with people in different situations where we didn't get along or we had problems, and it becomes very, very stressful and very, very difficult to do that on a day-to-day basis as compared to working with somebody that you respect and at least are cordial with, even if you're not really big buddies.
Exactly.
We're talking about bringing something back to life. Bobby, when Ted and I left Kansas City and we got back here in 1976, and Tom was the booker then, did you know he could have started that thing up with Ted and Cowan again, and it would have probably meant more?
Sure he could have. Not only would the folks remember it, it would have been a whole new generation to watch it. I mean, it's...
Exactly, and still there would have been people that would have remembered it because it was, what, 4 years later or whatever? And
yep.
The two of them would have been older, even more experienced.
Correct.
And with Tom running it, can you imagine? But I guess that was never, you go on to something else, and I guess you forget about it. I mean, that would have been something worth trying.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of Bo James, he's on the line. Well, I'm going to put him on with us, so maybe he can give us some. I know he wasn't old enough to remember Ron Wright and Whitey Caldwell, but I'm sure he's heard stories. That's
listen,
the legendary.
Listen, man, he took me. He showed me where Whitey Caldwell lived.
Bo James, you're just a mark, aren't you? We're all marks. That's what makes it special.
especially for what was good.
Exactly.
Yeah, I took Bobby by Whitey's house where Ron and Don Wright grew up, took him over by the wrestling office in Kingsport. He got the whole wrestling tour of the city.
And I'm amiss for not saying this at the top of the show, but now that I've got you on, you just rang a bell for me. We lost Don Green this week, who was a legend in Tennessee. He and his brother Al, or his wrestling brother Al, they first came to Mobile in 1959, and not only were they named Green, they used to dye their hair green. And they were a big hit when they first hit Mobile, because nobody had ever seen anything like that before. But they were absolute legends in Tennessee. And somebody else that had Tennessee connections, Gene Sheffield, or Gene Hall, as we most of us knew her as, who was the widow of Herman Sheffield, who was the Tupelo promoter for Gulas and Jarrett for many, many, many years. And after Herman died, she and Dennis Hall got married a few years later. And, of course, we lost Dennis last year. But Gene passed away over the weekend. And my condolences to the family and friends and fans of both of those people, because they were special people. Especially, you know, Don Green was just... He was a whale of a worker.
He worked here for a little while after the All South split in the early days of when the Atlanta booking office was, trying to put together a roster. He came down with some of the other Tennessee guys for a while, and that was the only time I ever saw him work consistently. I had seen him a few times in Tennessee where he was considered much bigger star working for Nick Gulas, but he was an excellent journeyman wrestler, and I thought that he had a lot to offer. He actually probably remember that, Mike, in Tennessee. He actually worked under the mask as one of the Mr. Wrestlings at one time.
Yes, he did. He absolutely did. And unfortunately, Bobby just dropped off. I guess he hit a dead spot. He should be calling back in here in a few minutes or pick up the line here, one or the other. And but he also, and Jay, you may know this, and Jerry, you may know, didn't he team briefly with Curtis Smith as one of the Infernos?
I'm not familiar with that, but I maybe am. I think you're right. But some of that stuff.
I think he was after
is,
Doug Gilbert.
Yeah, some of that stuff is
Gilbert left, and then I think Don Green. You know, it wasn't long. It was maybe
correct.
A month or so.
Yes, correct. And, yeah, you're right. But that's some of that stuff is, you know, so buried in the brain that it's hard to bring it back, you know. But you're right.
And, of course, he worked in Florida. He and Lawler worked in Florida as the MASS superstars and had Sam Bass with them. And then Lawler left and Kurt Von Steiger filled in. Again, it was a short period, maybe, you know, a month, 6 weeks, something like that. Before that ended. And,
hey, do you know the story how Lawler ended up in Florida with him?
No, I don't.
He got fired from Tennessee. He refused to go to Johnson City. And he left, and you know, this led, the week that he got fired and went to Florida, because he wouldn't go to Johnson City, is the week that George Barnes and Bill Dundee debuted on Memphis TV. And they got the top bill because Lawler was gone.
Well, you know, if you hear, and I've never heard Bill actually come out and say it, but if you ask him, I'm sure he'd say Lawler left because he was afraid Dundee was coming in.
he told Jarrett he wasn't going to Johnson City. Champions didn't have to go to the small towns, and Jarrett walked over and picked the belt up and said, well, you're no longer the champion. In fact, you don't work here anymore.
Why did Sam quit too that night?
I guess.
Hmm.
You know, but it was only a few weeks, and then they brought him right back.
Yeah, yeah. There's a video out there of Lawler and Green as a superstar working with Billy Robinson and Tony Charles. If you've never seen it, look it up and watch it. It's a tremendous match. Four great workers. Go ahead, Jay.
I missed the first part of the show. Has anybody talked about the did you talk about the Wrestling 1, Wrestling 2 feud that took place in Georgia?
No, I didn't.
Do you remember that? I mean, it was shortly. It wasn't too long after you know, the roster was put together and Tim Woods had introduced his protege, Wrestling 2, and somebody decided that Johnny Walker should, you know, have a program with Tim Woods, which I thought was one of the most ridiculous things you could possibly do. Here was two guys that were drawing both main eventers as top baby faces, and they put them together in a series of matches that drew pretty well, but it just didn't make any sense to me. Now, I knew that in Florida prior to Johnny Walker coming here as Wrestling 2, he had worked as the grappler down there, and
right.
He and Tim Woods had a program in Florida, and interestingly enough, Woods as Mr. Wrestling was the heel there,
right.
And worked with a steel leg brace. I saw some film of some of those matches, and I guess because of that, and it drew that they decided to try something here like that. But to me, it just didn't make any sense. You know, Wrestling 2 came on and told Gordon he had been around long enough, and, you know, he should be Mr. Wrestling, and basically started the feud, and it went on for quite some time. It was one of the few times that I can, at that stage, which was the, you know, I'd say 74, 75, where you actually had fans that cheered the heel. Two had done so well here and had such a large amount of fans that some of the folks, you know, wouldn't turn against him, which was not the way you wanted it to work at that time. And
was that the reason for the? I thought the reason was because Tim agreed to unmask to get a shot at Jack Briscoe.
That was something that he agreed to do,
right.
But. You know, Walker, or Mr. Wrestling 2, he certainly never would be called Johnny Walker during that period of time. You know, he said he should be the number one contender. And, you know, he challenged Woods. And they worked all over. And it ended up with agreeing to a mask versus hair match because by that point Woods was working without the mask.
Right.
One of the times he went back with it, and it ended up with Woods actually, you know, having his head shaved in the ring. And shortly after that, they did a deal on TV where Wrestling 2 came out with a hatchet and a piece of
right.
A board and stuck it in there and said they buried the hatchet. But to me, it just, you know, it with the number of top heels that were around, it just, to me, didn't make any sense at that particular time to run that program. Bobby,
well, Jerry, you were here at that. You were still in Georgia at that time, weren't you?
No, I wasn't here.
Oh, so you had left. And Bobby can speak on this once he gets back on the line. But what I've always heard is that Bill Watts, basically, because that pro, the Assassins had split in All South and were doing so well with that, that is it, we got Charlie on the line or what?
No, you got me.
But that Watts kind of stole that idea and decided to take his two top mass men and do the same thing.
Well, that's a good possibility. And like I said, they had worked that program in Florida previously before Walker had come here as wrestling too. Except in that situation, Walker was the heel Walker was the babyface and Woods was the heel, which was something that they never would have let folks know. You know, and at that time, if you didn't watch the local program, most fans didn't know what was going on. But that's the way it worked in Florida, and I guess it drew money.
Hmm. Yeah. Bobby, was that the general consensus on the All-South side that Watts had taken Tom's idea?
Sort of, yeah, pretty much so. But there again, there was guys here that knew they had done the same thing in Florida. I mean, those kind of things, and I don't know how the other side was, but just speaking from the side I was on, that kind of stuff wasn't talked about much.
Yeah, I guess not.
I mean, the only thing that we kind of laughed about was when Tom brought Gorilla Watts in. That was kind of a funny thing, but, you know. I mean, they did pay attention to what was done on the other side. The remark that Bill made, you know, Watts made on an interview on their show about, don't pay attention to that other bunch. Their Georgia heavyweight champion is a garbage man, referring to Ray Candy, who Tom had put the belt on. And, of course, Ray did work for the city of Atlanta in a sanitation department before he started wrestling full-time. But that's what led to Tom and Rock Hunter doing the semi-shoot on TV where they beat the crap out of each other. As far as guys was concerned, there was, especially in the dressing room, there was never much talk about it.
Yeah, I guess everybody, you were just there to make money.
We were just making a living, and, you know, it just wasn't. The only one on the other side that I ever talked to was Rocket, and we kept that kayfabe because neither one of us didn't want to think that our bosses was telling secret details. But, you know, there was guys there that got along with other guys and were friends with them, and they talked, and everybody knew that. But
Jerry and Ted were a perfect example.
They're brothers. Are they not supposed to talk? I mean, that was, you know. It was just
we rode to the same town together.
Yeah.
I bet Thanksgiving was stressful at your house. What? Or should have been,
man.
Right?
They really had a lot to talk about after they got the bell back and Ted was riding to the College Bowl in Augusta. God, what a dump that was. But, you know, it just, yeah, that's. There's only so many ideas.
Why didn't they go to another night in Augusta like they did in Columbus?
I don't know. I really don't know. I think it was maybe because Manderson, the promoter down there, he felt like he owned Monday night. And I think I honestly really think he thought that because his name was on the poster, Steve Manderson presents All-South Championship Wrestling, that people were going to leave the Bell Auditorium and go to that stupid bowling alley. And
is that where the matches were, in a bowling alley?
The first year we were in the Bell Auditorium, when the split came, Manderson had the contract on the Bell in his name. And when it came up for bid once a year. When he came up for bid, of course, Manderson couldn't compete with Barnett. And Barnett, whatever political clout he had at the time, got the contract, and when he got the contract, of course, we had to find somewhere else to run, and he found an old bowling alley that was, I think it was out of business. They wasn't bowling anymore, but, you know, you've been in a bowling alley. You know how the ceiling starts up kind of high back at the front of the lane, and as you get close to the pins, it gets lower. Well, in the ring, the ceiling was higher on one side than it was on the other, and it was no bleachers, all flat seating. It was it wasn't a very good setup, but we never drew much over there.
That sounds like the Rainbow Arena in Panama City, doesn't it, Jerry?
Yep.
Yeah, I made that scene.
Bobby, who got Lakewood for All South to use?
I guess I did. I mean, we never had any problem there. We ran outdoors at the raceway on those bleachers a couple of times, or a few times, I guess during the summer, and then we went inside to one of the exhibition halls.
Right.
And we had some bleachers that were constructed for us that, you know, you could take them apart, and we hauled them around. But once we went to Lakewood on a pretty regular basis there for a while, we set them up. And then
yeah, I went there a couple of times, and I remember it as being covered, not open air. I mean, I think it was open air.
We were inside the exhibit hall there.
Yeah.
That was once we got to auditorium, we never ran Lakewood again.
Right.
And we were talking about Dusty in Florida. Dusty had never been here until he made the big baby face turn down there, correct?
He came here as a heel.
Did he?
Yes, he did. First, you know, he had already been known as a heel down there in Florida, and he came up here a couple of times, and not, you know, just one shots, and he was a heel, and, you know, came to the ring giving his talk to you know, Briscoe, who was here for a title shot, I believe, and a few other folks, and but he was never here on a even semi-regular basis as a heel. When he came in here, you know, as on a regular basis or even semi, he had become a face, I guess, in Florida, and then, you know, that's the way he came in here. But yes, he did make a couple of shots here as a heel in the early days.
And I guess he's an example of, you know, even though he was so over down in Florida, of, you know, the magazines, you know, he was on every cover for years.
Right.
And, of course, you know, he got big in New York because Florida, you know, they syndicated their tapes up there. And so
right.
he was big up there as well. But, I mean, he drew everywhere he went. You know, he went back to Minnesota. And, of course, Murdoch had been there as heels prior to that, and Dusty had been there solo as a heel teaming with Larry Hennig. And so, you know, people knew him there. But when he went back as a babyface, I mean, it was just, and like Jerry and I were talking about at the top of the show, he never went back. You know, he wasn't back and forth. And that's
right.
That's kind of what, you know, kills it today is, you know, a guy will be a babyface for 2 or 3 weeks, and the next thing you know, he's a heel. Plus, you know, they have a horrible habit of taking two guys who are feuding and making them work tag team matches as partners, which to me makes no sense. But
yeah,
and
reading the wrestling news that I do, and that's the only contact really I have with the WWE because I don't watch it, but it looks like they're doing, you know, turns with their guys pretty regular. So that seems now today. But there's another area there is that today fans are as likely, particularly the young males, to be in the corner of or cheer for the heels as they are for the, you know, the faces, which is something that really didn't happen all that much back in the old days.
Well, there again, like Jerry and I were saying, how do you tell the difference? You can't
right.
tell by the way they work who's a baby face and who's a
correct.
Heel.
Nobody
and
believes
they all work
in
the
me.
Bobby, I got that? One for you. Ernie Ladd mostly worked the NWA areas as a heel, and but when he worked for All South, he worked as a babyface, and
mm-hmm.
he also did in some other independent places like Cleveland and whatnot. But you know, even after All South went away, and a lad worked again here in Atlanta, he was always a heel. But for All South, he was a babyface. Was that an attempt to draw a particular element to the arena?
Well, I think, yeah, probably. I don't know. I never heard that said, but probably. And also, they needed somebody with that size to work with Ox Baker.
Correct. And they worked together in Ohio, you know, and doing pretty much the same thing. And that was pretty much, to my knowledge, the only place that, you know, Baker and Ladd worked. Once again, where Ladd was the babyface, and they had that belt up there that Ladd brought to the All South area, and I think it was the NWF, or whatever they called it. But at any rate, All South was one of the few places, other than a few independent areas, that Ladd worked as a babyface. But he gave a good babyface interview, but I thought he was much, much more effective as a heel. Mr. TV announcer, that was never would call.
Yuck!
I don't care who it was. You were Mr. TV announcer.
That's right. I can't remember who it was, but there was a wrestler used to call everybody that interviewed him Mr. Mike Holder, and I thought, well, that was a guy's name, Mike Holder.
You know, that was probably you should have done that.
Well, Bobby, didn't Ernie turn heel just before All South went under? Or did they have Serrano as Super Soul Davis as a heel?
Super Soul Davis was a heel.
Oh, okay.
And you know, that was the guy.
Because you never seen a main event until you seen Super Soul Davis against Ernie Ladd. It was like Lord Littlebrook and Andre. it was really, you know.
I was trying to think of his name a while ago, but I remember he had worked in Mid-Atlantic as basically an opener, and he came in here as Super Soul Davis, and all of a sudden, like you said, he was working main events with Ernie Ladd, and it was unbelievable putting those two guys in the ring together, looking at the difference in the size of them.
His name was Don Serrano.
Yes. And it was really funny. But they did have some semblance of a match, but I couldn't believe it.
Well, for all the grief Don gets for being the world's biggest midget, he was actually a very good worker.
Yeah, he seemed to have a lot of good moves.
Very good worker. And he did the same thing down in Florida that you said that he did in the Carolinas. He was basically, you know, TV, you know, putting guys over, and, you know, every once in a while he'd get a win, but... he'd been around a long time. He worked for Vince Sr. in the Capitol days as Hector Serrano, which I think is actually maybe his given name, since his son's name is Hector, and Hector and I are friends on Facebook. Don was a very talented worker, you know.
Yeah, he seemed to, you know, he knew the business and knew the holds, and I mean, even to get into the ring with Ernie Ladd, I mean, you got to know something in order to be able to go a while with him, and it was interesting, but I just, you know, as a booker, never would have thought of the idea of putting those two guys in the ring together.
Well, at the time those main events started happening, you know, Jerry said something a few minutes ago about, you know, you work the long program and you got to blow it off. My analogy always has been you buy a watermelon and you slice that watermelon, but you can only slice it so many different ways, and then the watermelon's gone and you got to get a new watermelon.
Yeah.
That's kind of where we were. That promotion had got at that point. Our watermelon had been sliced just as much as it could. And, I mean, the talent pool was drying up. You couldn't get people, and the people you could get were not the quality that you wanted, and I don't think he had any choice. He had to try to do something. And
I guess Serrano, you know, being basically an opening type guy in most places he worked, couldn't say no to the idea of being in a main event type situation with Ernie Ladd.
Oh no. I never knew him not to do anything. I mean, he did everything he was asked, as far as I know.
Sure.
But, I mean, you look at the guys that came through here in that 2-year stretch, that had left. I mean, we had gone from having, God, I just went brain dead, the big barrel-chested guy.
Crusher Verdoux?
Verdoux, yeah, we had Oscar Verdoux here, you know, I mean, like a, he was like working with a mountain. And then all of a sudden you're, you know, Don, God love him, he wore boots that was built up 4 inches. And you know, they were, and they're still a great size there. But anyway, it had gotten to the point where he was just matching up whoever you could against whoever you could. And I think a lot of the guys that saw the writing on the wall. Jody and Rock stuck here till the end because they were, you know, they were loyal but guys that were trying to make a living, and especially the guys that were just getting started that were good enough to get booked somewhere else, most of them had gone by then. And we had a crew of some that, you know, I went to Tom one time and I told him, I said, Tom, I don't know where you're getting these guys. I said, but they're not what you're used to, and they're not what you're, the quality of what you got. I said, you know, if I can wrestle and help, you know, let me know. Don't know that I'm the quality you need, but I'm willing to learn. And, he said, I appreciate it. And, of course, just a month or so later, we were out of business. But,
well, he was probably indirectly or maybe even directly looking out for you there, Bobby. You know,
Could have been. I mean, I never thought about it that way, but you're probably right. Because supposedly my deal was in the works a long time before I got to it. But I'm thankful. Right place to right time.
Well, you mentioned Oxbaker and Ernie Ladd working together. Ernie was actually, when Eddie Einhorn opened up the IWA, Ernie was a heel there at the beginning. He eventually, he was a babyface there, and eventually he turned heel against Cowboy Bob Ellis, and they did a thing. But you mentioned Cleveland. They had a rare thing, especially back in those days. In Cleveland, again, this is something, if you can go on YouTube and find it, just type in Oxbaker Riot. Ox and Ernie were teamed against Johnny Powers and I don't remember who Powers' partner was, may have been Pampero Furpo or somebody like that, but they did a double turn. Baker turned on Ernie Ladd, and Johnny Powers helped him, so he turned too. And it caused those fans, Ernie just lay there and sold it. And you can see in the film, chairs coming from everywhere. And if you can imagine Ox Baker running on his tiptoes all the way out of that building, that's what it is. He's going wherever he can find an opening.
Johnny Powers left him in the wind, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, Johnny Powers ran and jumped that wall. I've seen that video.
That was some Tennessee stuff up north.
Hey, you talk about turns, Michael. Can you think of any turns that didn't work?
Yes, I can. I can think of, and I didn't see it personally, but from what I've read about it and the people I've talked to about it that were there when it happened, they tried to turn the Fields brothers, Lee and Bobby. Don was out of business by that time. But they tried to turn the Fields brothers heel in Mobile in 1966. Can you imagine that? After them, not only known, most people knew they owned the territory, but they had been the most over baby faces for almost a decade by that time. And they tried to run a program with them and the Lucas brothers, Ken and Chris, where the heels were the Fields brothers. And as Bob Kelly told me, the fans just farted at it. They were not going to accept that. And another one, not quite to that degree, but around 78 or 79 or so, Fuller tried to turn Randy Rose a babyface in the southern part of the Southeastern, and the fans weren't buying that either. I mean, you know, Randy tried every way he could to you know, get over as a babyface, and he'd been a babyface early in his career, but they weren't buying it.
Yeah. And when Lawler broke his leg in Memphis, they tried it with Tommy Rich and Handsome Jimmy. They tried to switch them heel. It didn't work. Neither one of them. I mean, the people cheered them no matter who they were in the ring against.
Jerry, did any booker ever suggest the idea of you and Ted trying to work a program against each other?
We did work against each other here in Georgia.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was for Ole, wasn't it? After the Vince.
So that was during the very late era when Ole was promoting.
Right.
Yeah,
well,
they
we
had
only
Ted
did,
and Rip Rogers as the Hollywood Blondes. Who was your partner, Jerry? Was it you and Ronnie Garvin?
Yeah, Ronnie Thumb. Yeah, but we only did it in tag matches. You know, it's kind of hard to do it in singles. People are just not gonna. They're not gonna buy it. I don't think. Not brothers, not real brothers.
No.
They teased it with Lars and Ole after Ole made the turn, but they never did. They never did book a match between them, did they, Bobby?
You know, I can't remember if they did or not. I know they. I know Lars had a bunch of shirts up, made up, but I know they sold a bunch of shirts, but I don't know if they ever actually wrestled each other or not.
Lars was trying to promote there, you know, and he got that infamous night where Ole did the turn in the ring you've talked about so much with Dusty there. Lars tried to jump in the ring because he was a baby face then, and I believe he got worked over pretty good. And I kind of think they did do at least a match in Griffin, I pretty much believe it. It may have been a tag match, but I believe that they did work against each other after that occurred.
Because Lars wasn't around long after that before he kind of took off, and he and Thunderbolt tried to start up that global or world,
right,
whatever it was.
But, you know, that was one of the deals where it was on 1 week and off 1 week, you know.
Yeah.
But I do believe they, you know, it was more talk than it was actually action in the ring. But I think Lars and Ole may have had at least a couple of tag matches. And the tease was that they were always in the ring against the other tag member, you know, and the fans would want them to get into the ring together, and it would just last just a couple of seconds. But I do think that it happened that way at least a couple of times.
Hey, Jerry, while I'm thinking about it, and this is a totally turn in the road from what we're talking about, last Friday night, up at Bo's TV taping, he had a young blonde kid, and I don't even know the kid's name. But, son, he did something I haven't seen in years. And he didn't do it once. He did it twice, and it was the prettiest thing you've ever seen in your life. He threw a frying head scissors.
You're kidding.
No, sir. Buddy, he got up there, hooked it, gave a little pose, and come right over with it. And I was sitting there. I was off camera back over there, and when he did it, I stood up because I didn't believe it. And he did it again. So I knew when he hit the second one, the first one wasn't a fluke. And then Bo told me the kid's just getting started, but buddy, he impressed me.
You don't see that anymore.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
You see a lot of stuff in my town you don't see other places.
Oh.
Yeah, I was. Bobby came in the other night. I had on a DVD watching a 1973 card from Madison Square Garden, and Victor Rivera was on there, and he did the luchador type head scissors where he'd catch with his ankle, like Mil Máscaras did, and he was working with Black Gordman, who was another luchador from, you know, came out of Mexico, and that was a decent match, but I watched that, and then right after that went off, I switched on, or maybe it might have been the next night, I switched on a they were running a Bruce Springsteen concert from New York City. And Jake can attest to this, having worked in both the wrestling and the music business. It's a similar principle. It's amazing how somebody can control an audience. And Bruce Springsteen, you may not be a fan of Springsteen, but he does it better than anybody I've ever seen. Totally has that audience in the palm of their hands. And I was watching that the other knife from Madison Square Garden, and something Springsteen did reminded me of that. I can't remember. Oh, it was the Victor Rivera Gordman match. They worked probably a good 3 or 4 minutes of the old bow and arrow thing, where you know one guy's got the other guy's arm behind him and he's pulling up on it, and then they go into a test of strength and reverse it, and of course the heel, you know, gets it back 2 or 3 times before the baby face finally reverses it. When Rivera finally reversed it, the roof of Madison Square Garden sounded like it was going to come off. Something that simple. You know, and people are so jaded now to seeing guys, you know, beat each other with chairs and baseball bats wrapped in barbed wire and all that, everything else. And, you know,
the thing, too, Michael, chainsaws. The people that go the weed eaters, let's not forget the weed eaters.
Yeah.
But the people that go to see Bruce Springsteen are not sitting in the crowd telling him how to play the guitar and how to sing.
Nope. You're absolutely right.
They're not yelling boring. Or going over to the announce table telling him you didn't announce him right, or you didn't do this, his entrance was wrong. And Bobby was there Friday night, our little TV taping. What a character we had show up there trying to tell everybody what they were doing wrong.
Oh, geez.
Well, you can't, Charlie can't help it. He's old.
No, it wasn't Charlie. This was a young guy. He walked in. I happened to be standing up front there talking to Charlie when the guy walked in, and I heard the guy. The guy tells me, well, I wrestled. He's got some YouTube with him in somewhere. But anyway, I'm standing there, and he don't know who I am, and I'm just standing there talking to Charlie, and I hear the guy tell his buddy, he goes, oh, look at the ring in there. He said, that looks like that's a real cable in them ropes. He said, I bet they're a little stiff. And I'm thinking to myself, what kind of ropes have you ever used, pal? And I knew right then he was a goof. And then he got up during the middle of the show and went over and told the announcer he wasn't showing enough enthusiasm. I mean, it was funny.
As the camera's rolling and we're taping TV, he's trying to talk to my commentator.
He probably worked in that ring I worked in one time in Fayette, Alabama, that had garden hoses and a boat tarp for a mat.
I love it. I love it.
Well, nobody jumping off the top rope from that ring, I promise you.
Oh.
At least we didn't have to carry the ring up 3 flights of steps, Bobby.
I heard that. You know, I told Charlie Smith, I was sitting there, and I said, Charlie, you're missing a golden opportunity. You could help him take the ring down and say you did it one more time. And he just looked at me like I was crazy. I couldn't understand it. Oh. Well, you know, we went Saturday night now, Southeastern, some guy, and I don't know his name, it doesn't matter, but they're doing a TV product there, and they're that's all it's for. They're not trying to run towns. They're just trying to put a syndicated show there. And they've actually got a little bit of talent there. There's some guys there that you could do something with if they had listened to somebody. But they got these two twins, and they look like Bo called them a circus high-wire act. That's what they look like. But they were working babyface against this team, and the people, you know, they're cute. I mean, they're like little Cupid dolls, and they probably don't weigh 170 pounds apiece. But they got some sympathy there. The people were with them. The heels were working the guy over. Well, they finally give the guy on the outside the hot tag. He turned around, put his back to the ring, and was looking at the crowd, going, "Yeah." And I was sitting there watching it, and I thought, if he was working with a heel that had half an ounce of sense, he would have hit him right in the back of the head and knocked him into about the third row.
There you go.
I mean, could you imagine Ted giving you a hot tag, and rather than you jumping in a ring and cleaning the house, you turn around and look at the third row and go, yeah, Watts would have come down there and drop kicked you off the ring.
Or he would have knocked me in the third row.
Yeah. I mean, Bo said something going home the other night. He said something now, and you know, I'm not blowing smoke because he's sitting here listening, but this is the truth. He said, and he made, and I never thought about this, but he hit it right on the head. We all grew up with a sense of mystery about this business because we grew up totally believing it was real.
Yep.
We thought we knew what was going on, but we wasn't sure. And then we got in the business, and I'll never forget Dickie Steinborn telling me the very first night I refereed, he looked at me and he said, "Bobby," he said, "always work a shoot." He said, "if you don't believe what you're doing, you can't expect them folks to believe what you're doing." And I've lived by that.
Well, it's just like you said those twins, they weighed 170. People in the audience are bigger than that.
Yeah, but those guys have never had what we had. They never had the mystery of this business. To them, it's always been show business. So they don't know. I mean, it's stupid, but I don't know.
And when you try to tell them and try to explain to them why you should treat it that way, they don't understand. Because they grew up during the Monday Night Wars when ESPN and ABC and NBC and everybody else was doing these exposés on the business. So they'll never have that belief because they can't even make themselves believe in themselves. And a lot of these guys that work now, they're so miserable through the week, they get to wrestle on Saturday and they come up with this character, as they call it, and they get to play wrestler on Saturday night and be that character, that they don't care what's good for the business. They don't care if people believe in the match. They just get to stand on a rope with their cape on and wave to the people.
And they don't want to put anybody else over. They want to be the star.
It's too bad there's not any Ole Andersons around to teach them like he taught Ricky Craven about about what it was like to be in the business.
Yeah,
you go to jail now. You'd serve time if you did that to somebody now.
Yes, I remember that quite well. It was hard to watch.
Oh, God, that poor camera. The lady that ran the camera at 17. She came out from behind the camera and stuck her head under the bottom rope going, "Let him go, you're killing him."
Well, I was close enough that I saw his eyes roll up in his head when Ole, let him have it coming off the rope. And, it was one of those things where if you had a towel, you'd want to throw it in there because it got to the point where, the master had taught the grasshopper every more than he needed to know in that match.
Ooh.
But that's another thing. But every one of us at one time or another has had our nose put in the mat. And we need that. Everybody needs that at some point in time. Just for, a rude awakening of, hey, this is a serious business.
Well, but that's exactly the reason it should be done. Because it is a serious business. I never thought it should be done just because some guy could say, "Hey, look what I can do to you."
No, not taking advantage of somebody, not picking shots, but I know I've been stretched a few times, and I'm better for it.
Taller, but you're better.
Oh, he is taller. He used to be one of Little Brook's guys.
Yeah. I since back surgery, I'm an inch and a quarter taller, so.
Oh, man.
Well, it was refreshing to see guys do some stuff last weekend I hadn't seen in a long time. And this business, I don't care what they say. They can holler it needs to, that it's entertainment, whatever it is. I'm telling you, there's still a market out there. People still want to believe, and if you gave them a product they could believe in, you could do it again. Maybe not weekly towns, maybe not every night, but you could do it where you could make money, and you could do it in a way that would be very respectful of what we used to do. And I think that's another key is you got a lot of these guys out there, they don't care if they make money or not. They just want to say, "I'm a wrestling promoter," or "I'm in the wrestling business."
That's true. The unfortunate part of actually putting together a product that is worth somebody to see and being able to build on that now is the sad part is that McMahon would come in and put on a free show with a bunch of top talent just to show you that you weren't going to make it.
There's a guy in Tennessee put on a free show Saturday night.
He sure did.
He puts on one every time somebody runs. He's just a local guy up there, but he puts a show on free in a parking lot across the street from wherever you're running up there because he feels like he owns the town.
Well, guys, while we got a lull here, I'm going to play Monty Hall and turn it over to Jay for a word from our sponsor.
You know, I almost stopped the car right before when we got started because I knew you were looking forward to me doing this, and my wife had critiqued me several times. No, you're not doing that good enough. at any rate, I'll put my hand behind my ear, and that's as far as I'm going to go with that and see what we can do with it. The Peach State Pandemonium podcast is happy to be sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment and information. They have over 150,000 titles to choose from, and you can listen to them on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now. And if you sign up at our URL, which is audibletrial.com/GWHradio, you can get one free audiobook and a one-month trial of the service. And I tell you what, there's a couple of words there. If you try to say them together three times, it's difficult to do. But at any rate, this looks like a great deal. You know, I'm going to have to do this myself. But thank you for giving me the opportunity to read a commercial. It's been a while.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what? It has bugged me for going on 30 years now, 35 years actually, who you reminded me of when you used to do the ring announcing at TBS, and when you said put your hand behind your ear, it clicked. Gary Owen.
Yes, you're not the first person that's ever said that to me.
And for those of you like Bo James who are too young to remember who Gary Owen was, he was the radio announcer and, all-around announcer on Laugh-In.
That's correct. I'd like to have made 1/100th of the amount of money that man made.
Hey,
I'm
Michael,
sure he did other things, too.
Oh, yeah.
What's that, Bo?
He was talking about turns earlier. He was talking about here. The biggest turn here, and it happened 2 years before I was born, but it's still talked about. Ron Wright, when he took Whitey Caldwell's place after Whitey got killed in the car wreck.
Yeah.
That was the big, he got killed on a Saturday night coming home from Moorestown. Well, TV had already played that week. No internet, no Twitter, you know, none of that stuff now. So it got made the local papers in Kingsport. But in each town that week, Ron Wright went to the ring and took Whitey's place and did an interview where he said he respected him and he was going to take Whitey's place one night only. And they had different heels in each town, so I don't remember who all it was that week. But, you know, they beat Ron every week to make him the babyface to come back with. But people talk about that. I mean, it's still talked about here quite often.
Oh, I can imagine so. Can you guys, Bo asked me the question, but can you guys think of any babyface turns or heel turns that just didn't work, that the people just didn't buy it?
Well, I'll go back to that wrestling, too, with, you know, Johnny Walker with Tim Woods here that I mentioned earlier. It drew a little bit because it was curious, but I really don't think people, you know, from the long haul, and it didn't last all that long. I don't think they bought two as a heel, and he just, you know, they did not want to see him as a heel, whether he was working with Tim Woods or not. They just respected who he was, and they wanted him as a babyface.
You know, Watts did that, turned him heel with Terry Allen down in Louisiana, and, you know, after years and years, and I was a big fan of wrestling too, you know, before I've gotten in the business and even much more so actually watching him work up close, I didn't think that was good. I'm sure he, you know, he was older then and he always came off a little grumpy anyway,
right,
just in his interviews and everything. But, and so, you know, people talk about that, you know, how good that angle was, but I didn't like it. And
well,
maybe it was because I just didn't buy two as a heel.
No, and, you know, people just want heroes, you know, and particularly at that time. And they didn't want to think of the idea that this guy that they had thought so much of was you know, going to do those kind of things in the ring that they came to see these guys get beat. They didn't want to see two get beat, first of all. And
right.
Secondly, they just didn't want to see him in that kind of match. And, you know, you can beat that to death and say, hey, I'm in charge here, and I'm going to put together the programs that I want. But after a while, you got to realize if that's not that thing's not drawn, you got to, you know, suck it up and do what you can do for damage control. And they did.
Now, Bo, you were following Continental. Didn't they try that even later with him and Pat Rose?
They tried it with him and Bob Armstrong. And it worked a little bit there just because, you know, in towns like Knoxville and some of the Alabama towns, you know, they didn't see the big run of Wrestling 2 on TBS. You know, so it kind of worked there because Bob was so over. But
right.
It didn't do nearly as good as Bob against, you know, the Stomper or the Fullers or, you know, anybody else.
And that reminds me of something else. Bob Armstrong's heel turn in, I think it was, what, 82, 83, Bo, in Southeastern?
82.
I would have never thought Bob Armstrong, because he was the consummate, he was like Dick Steinborn, he was a consummate babyface, but he made it work. And all he did was grow a mustache and start smoking cigars or cigarettes with a cigarette holder on TV and talk about Fannie Mae Titwiler.
Well, he slapped Charlie Platt. That worked,
yeah,
too.
And he slapped Brad. He slapped Brad, too, so that worked. So.
And he did it so simple by just dropping the knee on Fuller when he had Flair beat.
Yep.
And Flair liked it so well, Flair took it to Kansas City. And that's how they turned Bob Brown on Harley. Harley had him beat, and Bob Brown dropped the knee on him. And same, almost identical if you watch the videos.
Jerry, how many times did Bob Brown drop a knee on you?
I'm still punchy from it.
Oh, now that's one I know he was over in Kansas City as a baby face, but he's like to me like Bob Sweetan was in Southeastern. He was just too ugly to be a baby face. But
yeah, he was a heel.
It seemed to work.
There. But I'll say one thing for him. He was a hard-working guy. He worked his butt off. But he was always a heel when we were out there.
He'd thrown off the top rope every night.
Oh, yeah.
Every night. No matter how hard the ring was, especially in St. Louis. I've seen you watch the videos of him getting thrown off the top of St. Louis. He bounces across the ring once he hits.
And that was hard to do in that ring.
Yeah, I always heard that ring as hard as Chinese arithmetic.
I never understood that. As great a wrestling town, you could snatch a headlock on somebody and they'd pop. And they had the worst ring in the country there.
They had the biggest ring, too, didn't they?
Yeah, it was 24 by 24.
That reminded me of something, Jerry, you mentioning that about how a guy would want to work in the kind of town. You know, Marietta up there at the Cobb County Civic Center, it was a good place to go on Sunday night. They drew real well there. And as an announcer, the only thing that really upset me, and it didn't affect anybody else, but, you know, I always liked working off a really good microphone. And they had this little pager mic up there, something that you would use to call the guy with the forklift to come up and get the next load. And I hated using that microphone. It had the little red button that you push down. And, you know, one time, I don't know what, if they lost it or whatnot, but they put a nice mic on there, and I loved it that night. But you know, it's funny what things you remember, and with you it's the ring, but with me up in Marietta it was that doggone pager mic that they used there at ringside. And
you would have hated working at the VFW hall in either Selma, Alabama or Fayette, Alabama, because they didn't have a microphone at all. The referee stood there and hollered. They didn't even have a ring announcer. Larry Brock did
the
ring announcer. Yeah, I'm sure you have both. And they didn't have a bell, so they'd take a monkey wrench and beat on the corner post of the ring.
Well, you think somebody...
Well, let me tell you what I saw last Friday night. They didn't have a bell either. They took a pipe and beat on a horseshoe.
That sounds like Hattiesburg, bell. Mississippi, right?
my historic bell that I've had for years and years, come from Gulf Coast to Tennessee to here. My nephew left it in the building somewhere.
Oh, no.
So, yeah. And it's always one of the wonderful things you find out, you know, when you unload the ring hour for about, you know, before you start letting people in, you don't have a bell. So you can't just run out to the store and get one. So luckily I had old horseshoe.
Well, you had your nephew's head to use there in exchange for it that week, I'm sure.
I saw him ring the bell. I looked over and I thought, what are you going to do with that horseshoe? I thought it was Haystack's gimmick. They were, you know, like the Hall of Fame or something.
Yeah, if Chico Cortez had been there, he'd have been raffling it off.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, man.
When we started, you know, when Ann started All South, you know, she had the best intentions of the world of having a real first-class operation.
Sure.
And there were places we went, they didn't have a PA system. Well, you know, I started out, I was putting the ring up. Well, they found out I could do some announcing, so I became the announcer for the spot shows around where there, you know, wasn't anything going on. Well, we didn't have a PA system. So Ann went out and bought one of them bull horns like Barney had in the back of the police car. You'd mash the button, you know, and go, fantastic, one, two. And you know, you couldn't hear past third row, so you'd be up in the middle of the ring with a bull horn trying to do the announcing. Of course, the guys were ribbing you and laughing at you, and, you know, it was hard. But, yeah, that was I've got that T-shirt doing that. That's
the ultimate carny act right there, Bobby.
Yes,
you know.
Sir.
Well, that goes right along with it. Was it you, Bobby, that worked in a place that had the ring light over, was a wash tub with a light in it or something?
Oh, I worked in several places where they had a wash tub over the ring with lights in it.
Oh, man.
The worst place I ever worked was in Murphy, North Carolina, in a Quonset hut. They had a 100-watt light bulb hanging over the ring. That's true, man. Had a wire hanging out of the ceiling with a 100-watt light bulb.
Well, good thing Don Wright didn't work there, because Don Wright told the story that they had, Bo, you probably know what town this was. In one of the towns, they had a low ring light like that, so the boys always tried to, they bet a six-pack of beers to who could take a backdrop and hit that light. And Don said he decided he won it one night, so he went over and got real as high as he could and kicked it with the heels of his feet. But what he didn't realize is once your feet hit something, that stops your forward momentum. He said he went straight down on top of his head. He said he won the beer that night, but he never tried that again.
That explains a lot.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, man. So that was the story Bill Bowman told me, and I think he told it on this story. The Fields brothers were working with Don and Jackie Fargo in a little VFW hall in Robertsdale, Alabama. And no, it wasn't Robertsdale. It was might have been Leon. I don't know. It was one of those little small Alabama towns, but it had a drop ceiling. And this back in the 50s where, you know, drop ceilings weren't all that prominent. But they had a drop ceiling, match ended when somebody picked Don Fargo up and tossed him up in the air, and he went through the thing, and he grabbed the rafters and hung up there and was counted out.
Oh. Speaking of Bob Kelly, did y'all mention that Bob is in
the
hospital?
Yes,
okay,
I did.
Good.
And also that this coming Saturday is his upcoming birthday, and we want him to get out tomorrow so he can be at home with his family for his birthday.
Did we mention Larry Nelson?
No, I did not mention Larry. I mentioned Don Green. I mentioned Gene Sheffield, and I did not mention Larry Nelson.
Well, go ahead, that was a cue.
His real name was what, Larry Shelby, something like that?
I think so, yeah.
Most people who remember the AWA from the ESPN days, Larry was the, I think he did ring announcing, but he also did the play-by-play. And for my money, was much better than Mean Gene Oakland, who I never could take because he reminded me of a carnival barker. But as it turned out, one of our listeners, Dennis Mitchell, sent me a note today that Larry was working in Alabama as a disc jockey.
Yeah.
I don't know how he got from Minnesota.
Didn't he produce, he did the post production for the TVs too, I think.
I think so, yeah. I think so.
I think I think he's the one that edited the TVs and put them all together.
How he ended up from Minnesota to Alabama, I don't know, but that you know, as much as I don't like Alabama, that was a trade up to be able to get away from Minnesota with all that cold weather.
Minnesota is an old Indian word. It means weather suck big wampum.
Well, you know, the rest, it's not so much today because radio has become so much of a syndication deal. But back during the territorial days of the wrestling business, it was kind of like the radio business. I mean, a guy'd be on the East Coast 1 week, and he'd wrap up, and he'd be on the East Coast the next week, you know. So journeyman announcers, pretty much like journeyman wrestlers, they were used to packing a quick bag and heading out to wherever the next gig was, you know.
That's true. That's a good analogy. The radio business, my cousin was in the radio business up until last year. He spent his whole life in the radio business, and that's very true. There were people like, a lot of people don't know, Scott Shannon, who was a big, well-known in New York in the 60s. But he started out at a little radio station in Pensacola, Florida, WBSR, which is where my cousin worked. And a lot of those guys, I guess, you know, you were always looking for the high profile.
Right.
So, you know, if that opportunity called, you went.
Yeah, it was the, you know, the stepping stone of the small market, medium-sized market, and then make it to the major market. And they could, you know, some guys worked small market their whole lives just to, in order to stay in one area. And there was something to be said for being a big fish in a little pond sometimes, you know. But guys that had stars in their eyes, you know, they wanted to make it to the major markets. And a lot of times that's what would happen for them to end up in Atlanta because, you know, Atlanta was anywhere from 12th to 16th market for radio and TV. And Atlanta didn't pay reciprocally that well based on the size market it was, but it was the type area that a guy wanted to have on his resume. You know, and not get fired, that didn't help, but to have on his resume to show that he'd worked at a major market station in Atlanta, and it helped him, you know, get a job somewhere else, which could be, you know, 1,000 miles from there, but still he could show that he worked major market city.
Right. Well, and that's a good tie-in back into the wrestling business. Did any of you guys ever have the desire to work in Madison Square Garden at least once?
I did.
Did you?
I wanted to work there in the Cow Palace. I never did either one.
I thought you worked for Shire at one point.
Mm-mm.
On your way to or from Japan.
Uh-uh. Never did.
What about you, Bobby? Did you ever want to work there?
I never thought much about Madison Square Garden. I always wanted to work St. Louis. Never made it, but I would like to have worked the Keel. I actually would like to have done TV when they did it at the Chase. I remember seeing that as a kid and just thought it was the neatest thing.
Yeah, that was kind of like the top echelon of doing TV shows, I would think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was, you know.
Well, that ring there was just as hard as the one at the Keel.
You know, Sam,
Jay, I would imagine, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I would imagine anywhere you would have gone would have been a letdown after working with Gordon Solie.
Well, that's probably true. That being said, yeah, I think I could have taken Mickey Garagiola's job there, other than the fact that he was a local personality. And you know, I would have liked to have done ring announcing in St. Louis on that TV show. That would have been quite an honor and quite a thrill. And Sam Muchnick, you know, he always played it like it was legit. And you got that impression when you watched that TV show. Guys that would go crazy other places kept things under control when they would do their interviews on that show, because that's the way Muchnick wanted it done, because he had a reputation with all the newspaper folks and the TV folks there in that town, in that area. And I think from a wrestling standpoint, yes, working with Gordon was as much as anybody could want to do. But from the standpoint of ring announcing, I think a lot of guys would probably say, yeah, I'd like to work Madison Square Garden. But no, the Omni was big enough for me from the standpoint of the number of folks I was involved with.
Yeah.
But as far as doing something that was, you know, up there, ring announcing for the St. Louis show on TV, that would have been quite a thrill.
What about you, Bo?
I would have been happy working anywhere. You know, when I got here, the only territories left was Tennessee, Portland, and Dallas. And Portland and Dallas was on the end. Do you know who the first voice of St. Louis wrestling was? Before it was
Joe
on
Bear
TV, Joel. Before
Joe
TV,
Buck?
they had radio. And it will surprise you. Harry Carey.
I was going to say either Joe Buck or Harry Carey, but Joe Buck was a little later than that.
Yep, Harry Carey was the first voice of St. Louis wrestling when they first went on the air with radio.
Well, you know, back in that time, wrestling to a great extent got media coverage, and it was still considered, you know, legit, more so than later on in the 50s when it became something on the DuMont network. But he got a lot of newspaper coverage, and yeah, a lot of guys did wrestling when it was on radio and considered it, you know, a step to moving up to other types of play-by-play.
Well, you know, speaking of Chicago and the DuMont Network, you know who one of the, I don't know if he was the first, but one of the first
Jack
television commentators that was Dennis James.
That's correct.
He later
went
on with game shows and everything.
Yes, he was well-known, and that was one of the things. You know, he even at that point was a well-known celebrity, and that was considered a plus for them to have him doing that. And, you know, once again, it added to the legitimacy of what was taking place.
And I'm not
yes,
sure the market, but wasn't Steve Allen also a wrestling commentator?
Yes, he did that. He did it also.
Hmm.
And that's going back to the real early days, you know.
Yeah.
Who was the first play-by-play guy in Atlanta for the wrestling?
Ray McKay.
I was going to say Ray McKay. And
that's the first one I remember.
Yeah, Ray McKay, Skipper Ray McKay, when Live Atlanta Wrestling first came on the air, it was Ray McKay, and then Ed Capel followed McKay. Still worked with him some.
And, you know, everything was live then.
Yes.
So when Ed would take a vacation, then Ray would come back and do it sometimes, you know. So
Ray did the ring announcing the very first night Gunkel ran a show at Oglethorpe.
Yeah.
And then, after Capel, Gordon Soley came along. But, you know,
Gordon started
here. My dad, that was a funny thing. When it was still live, Columbia Sewing Machine Company was a sponsor of the of Live Atlanta Wrestling, and my dad, that's where he worked. And he used to take the sewing machines up there for Ed to do the commercials. But sometimes the commercials were even live.
I've got one for you, and I can just about guarantee that I'm the only one who knows the answer to it, but who was the first commentator for wrestling, not in the Gulf Coast, but the city of Mobile, who was also the last one that was a commentator for the last television show that originated out of Mobile? Same person.
I do.
Bobby and Jerry will know when I say the name, because he was also did the ring announcer for the house shows of Mobile, Jack Bitterman.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, he did when wrestling was live in the 50s up until
the mid-60s.
Did he
do the whole time, Michael, or did he ever have a break in there?
Oh, yeah. He did it until the mid-60s. And then from 68 until 70, they didn't have TV in Mobile. For Mobile and Pensacola, they did not have television. Then they moved to television to Channel 3 in Pensacola, and the first announcer there was Lynn Toney, who had done a kid's show for years and was also a radio disc jockey. And that's what Jack Bitterman was. Jack Bitterman was a radio disc jockey in Mobile the same time he was doing the television. And then he went to work for the Mobile Press Register. And that's why Mobile always got big write-ups in the newspaper, because Jack wrote them. And he worked for the promotion as well. But then after Lynn Toney left Pensacola TV in about 71, I think he did 70 and 71, and then Don Griffith took over, who there again was another disc jockey there in Pensacola. And Don Griffith stayed with it until about, I think he got sick around late 74, early 75. Then they went through a handful of people that they were just bringing in. And then they lost the contract with WAR and went to, in 76, they started taping the Mobile House shows and splitting it up into the television program, and Jack Bitterman did the commentary. He and a guy named Leroy Morris, who also had done, was a TV show host in Pensacola there for a while, but also did the commentating on Pensacola TV and Mobile TV during the 50s or the 60s and 70s, early 70s. He would fill in for Jack every once in a while in 76, and then by that time they started what was the live show in Dothan. They started taping and bicycled that around for the last year they were in business, which was 1977.
Did Gordon do Columbus TV too, or who did it?
No, that was
Jim Carlisle.
Carlisle.
Gordon went down there and did a couple. You know, did it a couple of times. Just I don't know if it was just when Carlisle was on vacation or what was, but I've seen some video of him doing that. Of course, he worked down there in Alabama for a while too. But
yeah, when Fuller first opened up in 78, Gordon did the TV show.
Right.
But that didn't last very long, maybe 3 or 4 months, and then Gordon was gone and Les Thatcher came in. And for a while it was Les and Dick Steinborn, and then they finally let Charlie Platt take it over, who Charlie, even though he had been around Dothan TV during the Fields days, he just did ring announcing. He did the ring announcing for TV, and he did ring announcing for the house shows in Dothan. But Charlie Gause and Al Roberts were the main ones that did Dothan TV. And then when Fuller came over, he let John Gause go, but he kept Al Roberts because Al was with Les for a while, and then he and Charlie were excuse me, Charlie were the main ones. And then, of course, later Al was gone, and they brought in tell me out, Bo, the kid's name that ended up in Kansas City, Rick Stewart.
Rick Stewart, yep. And he worked for
Rick
Kansas
worked
City
with you guys
Charlotte
when you guys restarted
right
All South in the 80s, didn't he, Bobby?
Yeah, 85. He came in, did the TV. He did the commentary. I did all the editing and the piecing together of the film and so forth, and he did a few shows, and then Freddie did a few shows for us. It was sort of a mishmash of a crew there for the TV.
And Rick's someone who does not get enough credit, as far as I'm concerned, because he played it straight. You know,
where was he from, Michael? Do you know?
You know, I have no clue where he came from.
He ref for the Poffos. He was a ref for a short time for the Poffos in ICW.
Well, that may have been from up around Kentucky then, but you know,
there's something in my head is clicking that he was from the Kansas City area.
May have been. That's where he wound. He ended up back there, and that's where he was when he died.
Thinking he was from around that part of the world.
Jerry, when you were going to Kansas City, was it Bill Kirsten that did the TV
Kirsten,
there?
Yeah. He's a good guy.
I never had the opportunity to hear him. Well, I take it back. He may have been the one calling the Harley Race Dory Funk title change. I'm not sure. I know that was a live match in Kansas City, but he may have done the voiceover for it.
Gary, what was the guy's name in Portland? Frank, he was real
Frank
good.
Frank Bonamara.
In Portland. Yeah, he did the Portland TV until he got cancer. He was really good.
Yeah, he was good. Bob Caudle was good. You know, out of the Carolinas.
Nobody was like Boyd Pierce.
Well, the only fault I had with Boyd was he couldn't say the word wrestling. And that was the thing that I didn't like about Charlie when he first started, I guess Fuller finally got him to taught him the proper pronunciation was wrestling and not wrestling. And that was
well,
Boyd never.
He wouldn't have learned it from Tommy Rich.
No. But, it, most people associate that with the South, but when I was watching that Madison Square Garden tape, one of the ring announcers that they had in Madison Square Garden was Big Bob Freed, and he said wrestling. You know,
well,
so.
In some ways it kind of became a catchword, you know, and you could see it written, R-A-S-S-L-I-N.
Yeah.
Some people thought that was putting it down, but in some ways it was to differentiate it from amateur style. But
that's true. The Texas TV show out of Dallas in the 50s was called Texas Wrestling, and that's how they spelled it.
So it was West Virginia territory, Saturday Night Wrestling. That's what it was on the screen when it came on. It was in the TV guide like that.
Is that during the Jan Madrid days?
Yeah. Yeah, we surely love commentating.
Whatever. Do you know whatever became of him, Bo?
Who's that?
Jan Madrid.
Jan Madrid got killed.
Did he?
When he got out of the business, he opened up a restaurant. And somebody robbed him, shot him when he was leaving the restaurant one night.
Yeah, that's how Corsica Jan died.
Yeah, I was thinking Jan was like, I'm trying to think, somewhere on the Gulf Coast. I can't remember. I'll have to ask Joe next time I talk to him.
Hmm.
He would remember.
Because Jack Curtis Jr. asked me about him a couple of years ago at one of the Mobile reunions, and I didn't know. I knew he never came back to Mobile after he left, or at least wrestling-wise, he never came back to Mobile after he left there in the 60s. And any results you see out of West Virginia, he's always on the card. And when they had the big thing.
He was West Virginia's wrestling, too. Jackie Fargo, you know, Johnny Weaver. I mean, he was the man in West Virginia.
Really?
Yeah, Jan and Gene Madrid, that's the first names up wrestling fans' mouth up there when you talk
and
to them.
And Gene, of course, was
Gypsy Joe.
Gypsy Joe, who had worked in Mobile as Joe Madrid. So they had known each other for a long time.
Okay, Bobby mentioned about the sewing machines and Ed doing the live sewing machine commercial. Everybody remember Guy Sharp, who was the weather personality here in Atlanta for many, many years? He worked at Channel 5. Well, Guy was the announcer back in the days on the weekend highlight show for the college football. And part of what he would do the spots for Atlanta Dairies. And he told the story himself many, many times. But part of what he would do would be to pour a glass of the Atlanta Dairies milk and take a big swig of it and say how good it was. Well, one night after the rehearsal, they unplugged the refrigerator. And the next day when they did the live commercial, he took the big slug of the milk, and it was obviously quite curdled. And he tried to hold it down, but he couldn't do it. And it went all over the place, but that was one of the things that he liked to tell when he would do the rubber chicken circuit later in his life was the story about doing the Atlanta Dairies commercial where they'd cut off the refrigerator and he took the big slug of the milk and it was not what the sponsor was hoping to see on TV because it gave the impression the milk tasted like hell, but it was in fact the fact that it was no good.
Well, the best tie-in with between television and something else going on in that studio back. And again, this is before my time, but I've heard about it and read about it. Back when they were doing live television in Mobile on Channel 5, that same studio, they did a noonday cooking show. And they would frequently, you know, have, you know, guests on their local celebrities or whatever. And sometime around 63 or so after Mario Galanto had turned babyface, he was a guest on that show. Well, unbeknownst to the people who produced and hosted the cooking show, Lee Fields had set up for Billy Boy Hines to go in there and attack him live on television. And they tore the kitchen set up. Mario Galanto was involved in more live television fiascos than anybody I know of.
I could imagine the housewives tuning in for that show really got a shock that day.
You know, he did the famous thing in Columbus where he was arrested for, well, actually Billy Hines, I guess, was arrested. Or was it the other way around? Which one of them hit one with the roll of quarters and was it was a Mario. He got arrested.
It was Don Carson and Billy Boy got in a fight in a restaurant downtown.
Yeah. It was a seafood restaurant, wasn't it?
And, it was an Italian restaurant. They took him off the jail. Oh, they got a old man. Good God.
It was Mario and Billy Boy Hines. They were working, like, of course, Columbus TV was always live. And just as he hit him with that roll of quarters or roll of dimes or whatever it was, and of course, change went everywhere, and, you know, Billy either hardware or bladed, he got juice. And the chief of police of Columbus, Georgia, happened to be watching it on television. He promptly got in his car and went down there and arrested Mario Galanto. And then Mario, famously in Memphis, was it Memphis or Nashville, Bo? He went on TV and tried to jump Jim White or Jerry Lawler or somebody with a billy club or a baseball bat or something.
It was in Memphis. He hit the ring on Jarrett and Lawler, and they had the club. They liked to beat him to death. It was a setup.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Why else would they have a tire buddy at ringside when they've never had it before? They were waiting on him. Matter of fact, I just give Bobby a couple of audio tapes to put on CD. And one of them an interview with Galanto on the radio a few weeks after that happened in Memphis.
Yeah, I had that at one time. I can't remember who gave it to me, but... I had that at one time. Of course, that was one of the things I lost in the fire. But, yeah, he told me he had that, and I definitely want to put that on. I'm going to put that on my iTunes and put it on my iPod and just play.
Then send your money to Bobby Simmons in Georgia.
No, Charlie Smith is paying that for me.
Do I?
I said Charlie Smith said he'd pay that for me since, you know, he's going to pay you for all those tapes you're making for him or those DVDs you're making for him. I told him just throw that in there, and it's – You'll see it when you see it.
Bobby's got live Knoxville wrestling too. Some audio from there, 90 minutes of the interviews for Friday nights.
I definitely want a copy of that. I got Bobby had on CD that I put on, loaded on my iTunes, a lot of stuff that Dean did in preparation for his, Dean Silverstone did for his book. That's some interesting stuff. You know, some tough Tony Bourne and Shag Thomas and interviews and matches being called, you know. Of course, it's just the audio. But I had also, and I'd give anything to have it now, some stuff from 1974, some audio from the live show in Dothan with Dick Dunn and J.C. Dykes and the Mighty Yankees and Baxter the Pro and all that stuff. I had that for years and would listen to it every once in a while on cassette, but that got lost somewhere along the line.
Like I told you, a couple of weeks ago when I was living in Albany, I saw that show once live, and it was unbelievable. It was wild.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, they were making matches on TV, and it was just, I mean, throwing stuff right and left, and you know, I'd seen some wild stuff, but those guys were just unbelievable. You know,
what year was that, Jay?
Summer of 71.
Too bad you weren't seeing it a couple of years early. In 68, Joe and Bill were working as the interns and had Jerry Graham as their manager, and they did a deal on TV. But they had a big feud going with the Perez brothers, Roberto Soto, who was Pepe Perez, and Ramon Perez. So they did a deal. They were going to have Jerry Graham burn one of them on TV with the cigar.
Right.
And I think it was originally going to be Soto, and, you know, we all know Roberto. He talked him out of it real quick with that hot Latin temper of his and talked him into doing it to Ramon. Well, the problem was they never told Ramon they were going to do it. And it wasn't kayfabe. I'm sure Graham was probably half, if not all the way, lit, and he burned him with the cigar on live TV. And, of course, that got over like $1 million and drew people at that farm center and packed it out, I'm sure. But, yeah, they did some crazy stuff. Of course, you know, that group, they were all branch Welches, so, you know, that was born into them doing all that crazy stuff on TV.
There you go, talking about our Tennessee heroes again.
Well, you know, anybody that the promoter would give a fan a brick to put it in their purse so they could knock Don Carson out with it. Oh, man.
Don Carson. Okay, here's the announcement, ladies and gentlemen. Jerry has to get up early in the morning, so we
have
to
start. Yes, I got to bail out. I'm going longer than I thought.
Yeah, I was going to say it's almost 10 o'clock.
Do they kick us off?
I appreciate it, as always. And we'll get together and do this again next week. Bo, I appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, I'm glad to talk to you. I'm glad you're back on the air.
I am, too. My voice, my beautiful, mellifluous voice has left me for the time being, but I'm getting through it.
What voice?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to use an Alabama word for you.
Hey, me.
Well, thank you guys as always, and we'll get together next week and we'll do it again.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Thanks, guys. Good night, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.